Welcome to Overtures. An important content note. When this episode was first recorded, my guest Rowan was using a previous name of theirs. In preparation for the release of this episode, we chatted and they gave me permission to upload this episode with their former name. I have replaced audio with their current socials, have updated all titles, descriptions, and links on this podcast episode, as well as the original YouTube episode with their name. Enjoy this episode and then immediately go check out the amazing things that Rowan has been up to since this episode aired. Content warning for discussion of transphobia and mention of addiction. Take your seats, we'll be starting shortly. Hi there, hello everyone. I hope everyone's doing well, and I hope everyone had a really great Easter and Passover weekend for all those who celebrate. I know I personally spent it dyeing eggs and eating maybe probably a little too much candy, but you know, as you do. Easter has really great candy, so sue me. Got to see the play Hitler's Tasters at New Light Theater Company the other night, playing at Theater Row. Fantastic play. If you get the chance, please go see it. And then I'm getting to see POTUS on Wednesday, and I am personally so stoked. And tonight, I'm going to Green Room 42 to join in the celebration for Take a Bow Podcast's 100th episode. That's hosted by Eli Tokash. And I'll post some clips on the Overtures Instagram so you guys can come join me tonight. It'll be a grand old time. But with that, let's get started, shall we? Welcome to episode 27. I'm going to actually start by playing a very quick video, but that's because I think my guests can introduce themselves maybe a little bit better than I can.
M.A. Pansexual, polyamorous, non-binary person. And if you don't know what that means that I've never made a single decision in my entire life.
Okay. No, but for real though, I'll read their bio now. So my guest today is a comic and storyteller based out of Brooklyn, New York, with a long background in acting, directing, and writing. They're also the co-founder of Write Hive, a nonprofit dedicated to providing free, inclusive events, programs, and resources for writers of all backgrounds. They're incredibly funny, and you might have seen them on TikTok. If you haven't, then you should go follow them on social media after we chat. But yeah, with that, this is Tyler Zioli.
Hey, thank you so much for having me, Laura.
Absolutely. No, I'm so excited. I was like, we need to catch up. This is going to be so much fun and a great way to do it. But yeah, how are you doing today?
I'm doing pretty good. You know, had therapy earlier today, so we are thriving.
Hell yeah. Hell yeah. Love that for you. But yeah, for context for those watching, how do we know each other? We went to college together for a little bit.
For a smidgen of time.
A little smidgen of time. You're a year younger than me, but your roommate was a friend of mine. And I'm trying to remember, I know we met through Morgan also, because Morgan knows everyone and introduces you to everyone. I'm trying to get him on the show soon, so don't worry.
Honestly, the mysterious man behind everyone, Morgan Brown.
Truly. It's like, how did you guys meet? Oh, probably Morgan. It's like, yep, that makes sense. And then I'm trying to remember, did you music direct Tick, Tick, Boom?
I did, yeah.
That's what it was.
When I was the beginning of my second semester, music directed Tick, Tick, Boom.
Yes, I remember that. Because I was like, I know you worked on Tick, Tick, Boom in some fashion, but I couldn't remember what it was. But that was a really great production. And previous guest Zach Norris was in it. And
that was such a great show. And definitely really seeing it, the movie of it, I was like, oh, all of these flashbacks happening.
Yes. Same here. It was so funny. Like when like the green dress song came on, but like on the radio in the movie version, I was just cackling to myself because I just couldn't help but thinking just like the whole like dance and things like that in the stage production of it. It was just so much fun.
Fun story, actually. There was a day that I was supposed to go to rehearsal for the show, and I was coming back from Buffalo Exchange in the city, and I was a little bit late for rehearsal. It was going great, and then this dude who like clearly had one too many Fairy Margs just threw up all over me, and I was like, I'm not going to a rehearsal today.
You're like, it's not gonna happen. Sorry, rehearsal canceled.
Like, sorry, everyone. You know, I don't think anyone blamed me. I don't think anyone blamed me.
No, because I also don't think anyone wanted you to attend rehearsal after that happened. It's like, no, go. No, seriously, go shower. Go do it. Do what you need to do. Please do what you need to do. Oh God. Like, I'm just thinking about that. That must have been a very uncomfortable shuttle ride back to campus.
Yeah, it wasn't the best. But you know, I think those drivers have probably seen worse. But like 1 a.m. with drunk college kids, a little random man vomit.
Yeah, exactly. Just maybe a little bit of smell. You know, it's fine. It's fine. How did you first get started in theater?
So actually, the first ever like theater thing that I did was, I think I was like 5 or 6. I was at Jewish summer camp, as we are wont to do. Yes. And I was in a production of Mary Poppins. And I was like, oh, this is fun. Like a little, you know, little chimney sweep, little dance moment.
Yeah.
And then my cousin went to a theater camp that was like a sister camp that was just for theater. And I didn't want to admit that I wanted to do theater. So I was like, I'm just going to go and, you know, annoy her. Like, I'm just going to do that. And then did that for a while. Ended up doing community theater. Was like a touring children's theater actor and director for a while. And that's kind of a nightmare. Like, just going all around Long Island and New York performing for very small children. The woman who was like the director of that was a cult leader, or not a cult leader. She was in a cult. It was a whole thing.
Children's theater, cult, you know.
Honestly, a pipeline. Like, I'm not going to lie.
There might be a pipeline there. Yeah, no, children's theater is a lot. And like, I've heard stories of people who have done like essentially the van tours of children's theater. Like on the road where you're like, you're doing everything. You are setting up your set at this like auditorium, tearing it down, going to the next place. It's
you're changing in the bathroom of this church that doesn't have any heat, any insulation at all. It's the middle of winter. It's Cooperstown, New York. It's great. You know?
Yeah. I'm sure it was a grand time. But you know, builds character ?
And those children will remember it. Not
forever. Not at all. Exactly. I think it's also funny that you said that you're like, no, I'm just going to annoy my sister. Like, I'm not actually going to get in theater. It always immediately makes me think of like Chorus Line, where like, he's like, the sister went to dance class. So, or like, she didn't go to dance class. And so he stole the shoes and took them, went ahead. And that was the end of it. You know, it makes me think of exactly that, getting into theater that way.
Yeah, no, it's very much that. And like, she doesn't really do much theater anymore. My cousin, she like is in radio and does other stuff that way, but definitely the performing aspect, I definitely kind of took the reins of. But definitely, I think you spoke to something there, and that like being socialized as a little boy, I wasn't allowed to like theater. It was just like, no. I can only go if it's tangentially related to her.
Yeah, it's like the little girls get sent to dance class and the little boys get sent to like sports camps and things like that.
Played baseball for 10 years.
yep, so exactly right up that alley. I think this is actually a really great time to share this other TikTok that you had sent me. And I think it'll really hit home with others. So let me add that to the screen so we can watch that.
So it's Trans Day of Visibility, and I felt that I needed to say something. Growing up, I was a theater kid, and I played all of the man-in-dress comedic roles. Like, all of them. And so I felt like I could only be feminine if it was for laughs. And the response to this video has been insane. I never expected any of this, let alone thousands upon thousands of people identifying with it in this way. I never saw myself in content when I was growing up, and seeing that I could do that for other people has been kind of life-changing. So thank you. Thank you a lot for making me feel safe to be seen, and thank you for laughing with me instead of laughing at me.
That was such a powerful video. When I watched it the first time, I was like, yeah, that, I think that really hits home for so many people. And I think it's really special that TikTok has created these communities for you guys to be able to express those things and share them with others. And I didn't see the original video, but I can imagine that the outpouring from the first one really was impactful.
Yeah. It It just hit 1 million views yesterday, and I just got 10,000 followers today. Like, it just hit as numbers, and it's insane.
That's crazy.
Like, yeah, I like, so tangentially related.
Yeah.
I filmed that video on my way to live action role play, where I play this character in this fantasy world where I can change my sex at will, because that's part of the species of the character. And before theater, like before being able to immerse myself in now and being able to express my femininity, honestly, the only places I was able to earnestly explore that was in these like tabletop role-playing games and in LARP and like these in-person communities that are typically ostracized in some way.
Yes.
But allowing yourself to explore it in that safe place is really beautiful. And then conversely, when you go into theater and it's like, oh, everyone kind of jokes about how theater is made for all these like gay men. And while it is true that a lot of like queer men and like non-binary people and trans people and people of all aspects love the artistic medium of storytelling that is theater, and to say that the only way one can express oneself is through this lens of like this cishet normative patriarchal structure, like even in this supposedly radical art form that's supposed to be changing lives, you're still being contained to, oh, this is what you are because this is what you look like. And like, we all know what typecasting is, and that's just an accepted thing. So yeah, it's having a virtual space like this is something I've never experienced before.
Yeah, and it's a very like bittersweet fact that you can receive this outpouring, because like, of course, it's wonderful that you again find this community where we can share these different things. But at the same time, it's the fact that so many have gone through this frustrating experience that it's like, ah, I wish there wasn't a need for everyone to relate to this. But yet at the same time, it's great that you can find those spaces and moments. And in response to that exact video, like, it's also crazy to me how often we still have this man in dress character for comedy, and how we're still...
How Mrs. Doubtfire is on Broadway, I don't know.
Tootsie on tour, like, despite how harmful it is, and even the attempts, quote-unquote, to make them better, but they still keep in the exact transphobic part that is making it the issue. I'm like, I think you're trying to tackle all the wrong things within this story, but... It's
like, maybe, in fact, we should be telling different stories.
Yes, yes. I don't know. Maybe to fight this, we should let the people who like are affected by this tell the stories. What a concept.
I don't know.
I don't know. Crazy idea. Way out there. And what also strikes me, especially watching that, is growing up when like the boys had to play women characters, or like that would have to dress like women. There was a huge to-do about the hilarity of it. Like, even in doing Shakespeare, where like Flute plays a woman in the play, and how it was kind of like one of our actors, he played it, and we were like, oh, this is so funny. But he took it in such a serious way that it was like, oh, this is really interesting and this is really specific. But meanwhile, the girls would often play male roles because there weren't enough boys, and that simply just wasn't an issue. So much of the transphobia is layered with sexism, and when it comes to this man in dress situation, that's so frustrating. Like, me playing a man in Carousel, like, was not an issue, but God forbid this boy play a feminine person. Like,
yeah, no, 100%. And that definitely goes to the underlying structure of like how systemic and societal like misogyny is. And it's like, oh, it's okay for a man to pretend to be a woman, because like, obviously, why wouldn't you want to pretend to be a woman? But like, for a man to give up his manhood, that is that's heresy.
Yeah, God forbid that a man lose his masculinity.
Oh dear God. Oh, emasculated? No.
Emasculating, no. Yeah, no, literally. So transitioning a bit back here,
transitioning,
transitioning, haha, but into, like, when we were talking about you getting started in theater, you still consider yourself a storyteller, although you may not necessarily be as much in the space of theater or so. But was there a particular, like, overture or light bulb moment that led you to decide that storytelling in its many forms is what you wanted to pursue? And also in conjunction with this, because Margot kind of also stole my question, she submitted, what moments of your life inspired you most to be an artist? So feel free to take kind of both of those questions piecemeal, however you want to answer it.
Okay. Yeah. So there's a couple layers, always some layers.
Absolutely.
I definitely have always felt myself to be the creative type of person. I've always found myself drawn towards art in some fashion. I was writing a lot when I was young, just like writing my own stories. I was acting a lot. I was like writing plays, doing YouTube videos. I was singing. I was like a classically trained singer and did like all of that stuff, and played like 7 or 8 instruments when I was younger. I didn't know that.
That's so cool.
Yeah, I was first chair viola. I played violin. I knew some cello. I played piano pretty well, played guitar, ukulele, just like basically all the strings was kind of my thing. So I was just trying to find creative expression wherever I could find it. I think especially because of the oppressive space that is Long Island, the very like white picket fence, like prototypical nuclear family. I grew up in a only child household. And so like having to be creative was like a thing that I just had to do to entertain myself.
I totally understand that.
Yeah. And then I think through all of that, I ended up finding, I'm also neurodivergent. I am ADHD and autistic. And so words specifically, like reading books, watching TV shows, seeing plays, acting especially, was how I learned how to interact with people and how I learned to navigate the human experience and be like, oh, this is what this means. This is what these feelings are. This is how people are supposed to relate to each other. And so through that, I made meaning for myself kind of through the world. And having multiple experiences like that of seeing art really impact people. Like I was my junior year of high school and I was in The Miracle Worker, which is a play with its own myriad of problematic elements.
Of course.
But I was the father in that. And the next day my English teacher came to me and was like, hey, I just wanted to let you know that like I had to like run out of the auditorium when the show was over because your performance was making me cry and think about how I am as a father I treat my children. And it like, I was like, oh, okay, so we're not playing games. Like, this is real.
This is legit.
And I think that was like, oh, storytelling, because that's how you're going to get through to people. And then to Margot specifically, Margot and I and a bunch of other individuals partook in a specific experience, as one does in college, and were able to view the world in a different perspective. And in that moment, I did a lot of internal reflection and kind of realized that stories are the way that not just I learned how to be a human, but how people interact with each other. And so going off of what I said before, seeing myself reflected in these stories, trying to make sense of the world, I recognize that that's what everyone needs. And so in becoming an editor and tying off into like my nonprofit, I got really dedicated towards the idea of making sure that people told their stories and or had stories that they could make sure that they saw themselves in. Because I think the more experiences we allow ourselves through story, because the way the brain works is that when experiencing a story, when really like getting in that immersive state of a TV show or a movie or a book or a play, your brain activates chemically in the same way that it does when you are actually experiencing something. So if you're experiencing heartbreak in a story, your brain is processing it as though you are experiencing the heartbreak yourself.
Right.
And so allowing more perspectives, more stories, more understandings of how life works for people there's a greater sense of compassion that is able to be had for people with experiences that might not be your own.
Absolutely.
And so, storytelling was the reason why, how I got into all of that. Sorry, that was long-winded.
No, that's okay. I threw a big, like, curmudgeon of things all together at you. So honestly, the first thing I was going to say was props to you for trying to handle both of those questions so beautifully at the same time. Yes, to all of that, Like, I'm pretty sure I've mentioned this exact same allegory before, and it's perhaps because I'm trying to work on editing this into like audio podcast form. So I'm listening to old episodes. but it's funny that you talk about people like watching it so that they can learn compassion and all this other stuff. It makes me go back to the Greek times where people were brought into the theater to watch it so that they could learn. It was a teaching experience so that you knew how to interact with people in a society and how extreme those situations were so that you didn't necessarily have to go through those exact same ones in real life, but just so that you could experience it at that level and bring it down to earth. And I think there's a lot of that in what you're saying as well.
Yeah, that like Aristotelian catharsis. Yes. Oh, yeah.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Good old catharsis. Good old Aristotle. He's very, very big on the catharsis thing.
Honestly, I'm a big fan of catharsis myself. There's nothing like a good scream cry when you're angry at a book.
Truly. Truly. Sometimes you just need sometimes it's just like pausing to like let it happen for yourself and then keep going. Definitely had those moments.
The interesting thing about like live theater though is that like, and like stand up as well, you are in that experience.
Yeah.
And there's something really powerful about like forcing yourself to go through that in a safe setting.
Yeah, in a safe, healthy way. But at the same time, like you can't just pause in the middle of like August Osage County, you know?
No,
like,
you cannot.
You're like you're holding on to that, but they're not gonna let you go. You just gotta keep going. Ride the wave, let it happen. So you're doing a little bit of everything, and we were starting to touch on that a little bit: writing, comedy, editing, TikTok. What else am I missing?
I think right now that's everything.
Gotcha.
I've gone through a lot of stuff in my life. I've been a filmmaker. I've been a musician. Yeah. Like you were saying before, I was music director of a show. I was like in the a cappella groups. So I was doing all of that. But right now I've really honed myself into editing and comedy. Like those two things right now are really where I'm most focused on. And I think it's really interesting how there's like this kind of juxtaposition of the two, because editing I think is much more similar to directing.
Right.
Than like writing is acting and editing is directing, like that kind of idea.
Yeah.
Where you get this high as an artist where you're like, oh, I'm in this creative space. And then especially when you receive the feedback, like on like in theater, that live performance of getting the feedback directly from the audience, there's nothing like it.
Yeah.
Sorry.
No, you're totally fine. You're totally fine. Take a drink of water.
but yeah, no, like there's nothing like that feeling. But there's a reason why so many artists and performers are also addicts. Like I am a person who has a very addictive personality, and I've struggled with addiction a lot in my life. And I know that if I just went for the route of chasing that high of performance and was only doing comedy, it would be an unhealthy obsession. It would become an addiction of just like constantly having to chase that.
But, so editing is sort of that balancing factor for you that allows you to continue to do both.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Because it's very much, it's not about me. It's about the writer. It's very much about like, how do I bring this out of you? How do I act as coach, as editor, as therapist, as friend, as cheerleader, all at the same time for you? And being able to support people in that way, especially people who've been told their whole lives that the things that they have to say and the stories they have to tell don't matter.
Right.
Being able to be the person who gets them excited to share their story is one of the most rewarding things I think I experienced in my
and especially getting to say like that thing you kind of just threw it away, but I want to know more about that. I'm sure that there's aspects of that, and so that makes me also wonder what came first for you when you were growing up, writing or performing.
Well, writing probably came first because I was very young and I read like Eragon and Maximum Ride and all of those like fun YA books and like made my own essentially just like fucking copies with like the names chain fan fiction. I wrote fan fiction. Let's not lie to ourselves.
Absolutely. No, no, no. People have gotten very far with their fan fiction. Let's be real. So hey, like, it's nothing to shy away from.
Absolutely not. Multiple bestsellers, lots and lots of money. Hey, go for it. All art is valid. Go do what you gotta do. But yeah, and so writing was that. But I dropped away for a while as I kind of got into other creative pursuits and came back when I was in college. I only changed to being a creative writing major junior year of college. Because I was intent on being a music education major and then a film major and then just kind of bounce. Okay, my advisor at Wagner, where we both went, I don't know if I shouldn't. Okay. My advisor.
We've talked about Wagner plenty on this show, don't worry.
Cool. My advisor, when I went as music education major, was the head of the music department. And he said, you shouldn't do this. Don't do this to yourself. And I went, okay, I guess not.
Yikes.
I mean, hey, would have loved to be a teacher, probably gonna go back and do it someday, but I'm glad where I ended up now. But I definitely did end up doing acting more for a while, but then through acting, found directing and came to that realization of how sustainable it was through doing that. And then was directing for a while. When I got to college, was also directing and acting, but once the ability to perform and be engaged in theater in an accessible way stopped being possible, I kind of couldn't keep it in my life, which I think is true for a lot of people.
Absolutely. I think that's completely understandable. And I can go into a whole tangent in that because I know you and I can talk forever, but I want to make sure we keep going and talking about the things that we want to talk about.
Absolutely.
So with that, I'm going to go into the next Instagram question. Also from Margo. Great question. What inspired you to go into comedy?
Actually, so the first time I ever saw comedy, stand-up comedy in any form, I was like 7 or 8 years old. I was with my cousin in his room. He turned on someone, probably like Bill Burr or Joe Rogan or something. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I don't understand why anyone would want to watch this. I don't get why anyone would want to stand and watch some bald white dude stand on stage for an hour at a time. And like,
fair.
Still valid. Still super valid. But I kind of dropped it for a while. It'd always been something I was super interested in when I was younger. One of my hyperfixations, being a neurodivergent child, was listening to stand-up comedy and then reciting it out to the people around me, which was super annoying when it wasn't funny. But a lot of the time, it was funny. And so I think through doing that so often in my childhood, I really learned what the structure of a joke was, just like subconsciously. And then I dropped it again for a while. Tragically wanted to be a ventriloquist for a while. And that was just the worst, like, 6 months of my life. But then I went on a cross-country road trip last summer, actually, because I've been told by a lot of people over and over again, like, you need to have really thick skin to stand up. Like, you need to, there's points to it. But it was always something that I was, like, warned against doing because I'm a very emotional person. But then I went on this trip this summer and I had only seen comedians for the most part who were straight white dudes. And I was in Denver for one of the stops on the trip and I met this comic. Their name's Lee Robinson. I definitely made the worst impression with them because I was just like just really coming into like being non-binary and being a little more femme, and was just so excited to meet them. And they like were like, yeah, we'll hang out and smoke after the show. And they just like totally dipped, which I do not blame them for. I would do the same thing now. But being like, oh, other people get to do this also. And then I got back to New York. I found open mics online, just went to one, and have been doing it since.
That's so special. It always comes back to representation. It matters because if people don't see themselves represented, they don't think that it's an option. And that's really shitty, to be quite honest.
Something I've heard from a lot of people talking about doing stand-up is how inaccessible they think it is.
Yeah.
And honestly, most things aren't very inaccessible. It's just doing things that people hear about is inaccessible.
Exactly. I think that's a really great way of phrasing that. And going back to what you were saying about when you were a kid, like learning and reciting it and learning how like joke structures come about and things like that, I think it's way more strategic and like narrative and or character driven than people think. It's not just like standing up on a stage and being like, haha, I'm funny. and I think that's, it's such a thing to be lauded for because it's hard. I've tried writing sketch comedy. It's hard. And I can imagine, yeah, comedy is just hard. I'm like, if you give me a script that's already written is funny, I know how to do it. Coming up with it is really difficult.
I mean, but you're like, but the thing is like, you're a funny person. And like,
thank you.
The thing about like formalized comedy is that people intrinsically and instinctively know what's funny, which is why like being a funny person is a really cool thing and like very, not easy to do, but some people are more disposed to it.
Right.
But then when you like sit down like, oh, why am I funny? That's some real like intense work that like people don't really think about.
Yeah, it's kind of like trying to like pick apart like muscle memory and being like, how am I doing? Or like trying to unlearn something. You're like, what?
But I think
it's just so more complicated.
Speaking to unlearning something though, when a lot of people like, I mean, I'm going to speak for myself here. When I was really looking at my own comedy, I realized like in person when I'm just like being funny, how much of that is based in self-deprecation.
Yeah.
And I think like Hannah Gatsby, if anyone's anyone watching or you have seen.
Hannah Gatsby's incredible. Like, honestly, if you're watching, obviously if you're watching live, like don't stop right now and go listen to it. But if you're watching at a later date and time, stop what you're doing. Go to Netflix, watch both of Hannah Gatsby's specials. They're incredible. Anyway, continue.
No, they're so good. Like Nanette and Douglas are absolutely incredible. And like people argue they're not stand up, but that's a whole thing. Like what is art?
It's
what's
solo,
a medium?
It's solo performance. Let it go. Anyway.
Like, exactly.
No.
But like very much like what Hannah Gatsby says in her first special is very much like, I used to do self-deprecating humor, but like deprecating to a marginalized group isn't deprecation. It's just humiliation.
Yeah.
And that's something I really had to come to terms with. And something that I found really beautiful with the TikTok that went viral was very much like, oh, I'm not making like, ha ha ha, it's funny. Like I have all these identities and I'm indecisive about them. But like the joke in that is like, oh, it's actually a lot of decisions all the time, always.
Yeah, I'm like, that's like the caption like of your TikTok. You're just like, ironically, I have to make like the most decisions.
And it's very much that. It's very much realizing, oh, you don't have to punch down on yourself to be funny. You can just talk about things and realize that you're not the only person who's experienced this.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's an interesting tie-in because I had a question from ChrisXC34, sends in a lot of questions to us. What's your general opinion of how comedians today discuss sexuality in their material? And this might be different considering like who you're watching as comedians too.
Absolutely. I think that's a very, thank you for the question, Chris. Also, thanks, Margo, but I didn't have to thank you. but like very, like when you say how comedians today, that's such a wide range of people because like what I assume they're saying is like, what's your general opinion of how like Dave Chappelle and Joe Rogan talk about sexuality? And that's how a lot of people view stand-up comedy in like the mainstream. And how they do it, bad, awful, terrible, not good. Very much
0 out of 10.
Yeah, like we can talk about like how technically they structure their jokes very well and yeah, whatever. But like when you're technically, like the technical aspects are good of something, but the content is awful, I don't give a fuck. Like, but when you're like, if you're in cities, go find queer and like stand-up comics who are black and stand-up comics who are trans and stand-up comics who are all of these diversity and all of these demographics of people, because everyone does stand-up comedy. Everyone has things to say about themselves.
The intersectionality.
Exactly. And yes, there are a wide, vast majority of like shitty straight white dudes who just tell jokes about how much they hate their wives and sex. Like, it's there. But I perform a lot in Brooklyn And in Brooklyn specifically, there is this huge blossoming scene of queer comics and comics of color and neurodivergent comics and disabled comics and people who are really talking about experiences that they've had, that when you really get more specific, you find that there is universality in all of those specific elements. That even if I can't relate to the story that a comic is telling about their disability, there's still like this intrinsic human element of it that you can still relate to. And so specifically how people talk about sexuality, you don't have to make fun of it anymore. Like, oh, haha, isn't it so emasculating for a dude to like be a bottom? That's not funny. It's just right. Misogynistic, really, ultimately.
Yeah.
It is funny, however, to talk about like being so confused that like you really just give up all decision-making power because it would be easier if you just didn't have to make a decision.
Right.
And that's the part that I think people need to focus on more. The shared experience rather than laughing at someone's expense.
Absolutely. And like briefly, it just makes me think of like when things are slightly more specific, it's funnier. Like if someone has this like really long like thing and then they add like someone's name at the end, like passive aggressively, it just becomes 10 times more funny. So I think there's something in that specificity that like this is a very like silly version of it, but the specificity still grants you like that universality, which I think is a really fun dichotomy there.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, getting all woo-woo for a second, like everything's a fractal of itself. Like it's all exactly. We're all just one big thing. And so like, I think this goes like, no matter what kind of artist you are, even if it's a serious as opposed to humor, the more specific you are with the experiences you're depicting, the more the audience is going to relate.
Absolutely. And then I'm going to keep going because I'm like, these are such great questions.
Tell me off if I'm long-winded or just like do something I can get.
Oh, no, you're fine. Because I'm sitting here, I'm like, this is great. So like, I'm the same way. The next one that I have is from David Leon, a former guest here as well. What is your approach to comedy writing? Because he says, for me, comedy is the trickiest of all, LOL.
Yes, absolutely. Also, hi, David. So my approach to writing, when I think about comedy, is that I can't think about it as writing. I really, because I come from a fiction background, I very much get into this mode where I'm like, yes, I have to be a writer. But so usually I start off my notes on my phone and something else is playing in the background. And I kind of let that passive part of my brain that's always working just like cling on to whatever it's going to notice in what I'm watching. And usually that will have a like spiral effect of like, oh, that's the thing I actually want to talk about. But very much, I personally think a lot about stories because I am a storytelling comic specifically. I think about things that have happened in my life that are either traumatic, realistically, or just like very strange, specific things that happen in my life. And then I kind of tell a story from there. And the way that I work through it is I look at the story. I go, okay, what are like the major elements of this story? Like, what am I talking about? Like a set that I do right now that actually identity set was from was a moment where in my early childhood, a bully that I had who later reached out to me because of my own sexuality crisis did some weird, strangely homoerotic bullying. And so like,
yeah.
A traumatic incident, but finding the humor in that trauma because more so than just like making statements with comedy of like, especially like big comics now, like, oh, I should be able to say whatever I want. I should be able to do all of this.
Right.
Making statements doesn't really mean anything because no one cares about what you have to say if you're just like declaring it. But
yeah.
Finding the shared experience, like I was talking about before, of through that traumatic experience, like, yeah, everyone knows what it feels like to be bullied by someone. And people can laugh at how absurd it is that this seemingly incongruent element of like the power dynamic of like me now being a like fully or on the process of being a fully realized queer person and him then the power dynamic then being switched. Right. And being able to utilize those aspects, but then bring out through it like, hey, we're all victims of this patriarchy and deal with all of these like things in our own way. And so finding the story, finding the things that are funny about it, and finding the thing that I want people to take away from it, usually that all happens starting from what's an embarrassing thing that I can remember happened to me.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. No, I think that's a really great way of going about it. And also thinking about it like it's not writing, it's this, mm-hmm. it's this other thing. I think it's a really fun one. Liam Abate wanted to know, what's been your most memorable stand-up experience?
Hi, Liam. So aside from the TikTok, I think one of my most memorable stand-up experiences was receiving the video from my first like big performance that I did at Broadway Comedy Club with the New York Queer Comedy Festival. Receiving that video back and hearing the audio of the audience mm-hmm. laughing and like it sounding like a comedy special, it was like one of the most beautiful moments that I was like, oh, I'm really doing this.
Yeah, because I'm sure live, like, you're like, cool, they're reacting well, let's go to the next thing, but you're not like fully taking it in at the moment because again, it's a performance. And exactly. So you're like, I'm trying to keep my brain on this track. I could imagine that, yeah, you're like, oh, yeah, okay, they did react well.
There was one time for a funny thing. There was this one time, I have a part in the story, sometimes in my day job, I ghostwrite erotica. And I like write sometimes problematic, like 50 Shades of Grey mom porn style erotica. And I tell this joke, and this guy from the audience goes, I've probably read it. And I was like, how?
You're like, how do I go from here?
Somehow I like, it was fine. He was still good with it. We moved on and I didn't have to address that any further. But I was like, okay, that I didn't expect that to happen. It wasn't even like a big room. It was like 10 people. I was like, you really just outed yourself here.
Getting into the editorial work and ghostwriting stuff that you're doing, how did you get into that? Because I could imagine, like, obviously getting into writing, like, it's its own thing, but I feel like sometimes editing, I guess that plays into the directing part of it, but I guess ghostwriting is maybe something that a lot of people don't necessarily know nearly as much about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so for me, how it happened was very much non-traditional, through, like, developing this nonprofit and networking through there, people kind of just were like, oh, you're like, I would be a writer just by myself. And like, we would have critique groups and people would be like, oh, you're very good at this. And so then through there, I met people like, how do I do this? And really finding community is how you do it. Like finding people who've done this before you, mentors to like kind of guide you through, like, this is how you do it. This is how you market yourself. This is how you mm-hmm. establish and get clients, all of that fun stuff. That's very much kind of how I went about it in that non-traditional way. But as far as ghostwriting, it was very much like, okay, I need money somehow. I need to get on these freelance sites like Fiverr, Upwork, all that fun stuff. And while I was like only putting editing stuff, this person reached out to me and was like, hey, do you want to ghostwrite this short story for me for X amount of money? And I was like, yeah, I guess I need money right now. And so I wrote it and then I realized I could do it. It's strange because it is taking up so much creative energy that
right.
you actually don't get in return and like you don't actually care about. So it's a very interesting, it is probably the most survival job aspect of like writing. It's like, it's close to like copywriting.
Interesting. Yeah, no, because I was like, I feel like this is never like something that's talked about. And I had a feeling it perhaps wasn't the most favored out of editing and ghostwriting, mm-hmm. but I figured I'd ask.
Someone's got to do it.
Yeah, exactly. And since we were already starting to talk about Write Hive a little bit, Chris XE, of course, I was planning on talking about it, but Chris XE jumped the gun and help me out here. Tell us about Write Hive's progression from how it started to where it is now.
Yeah, absolutely. So I was, I think it was 2019. It was like September of 2019. I met this person online, like through Twitter. Someone posted like, hey, I've been thinking about starting this virtual convention because writing conferences are like really inaccessible. They're very yeah. expensive. People can't get to them. And if you can get to them, you have to buy all this stuff and like
right.
it's a problem in the publishing industry, and hence another reason why only certain stories get told. Mm-hmm. So I was like, yeah, perfect, amazing. I have, in my many things that I've done through my life, I've also been a marketing director for this company that sold vapes and CBD and all of that. So I have some graphic design experience. And I was like, yeah, I'll design you a logo. And me designing a logo became me becoming the executive director of this conference we were trying to make. And through us developing this conference, we were like, oh, we should just make it a community. Because if these people are already here in the Discord channel for the conference that's happening later in the year, we might as well just engage them now. And so through doing that, it just developed. And we then started trying to figure out ways we could tangibly help people. So we started a grant to sponsor an artist. So we've given away, I think as of right now, $1,500 to three different people to help them market their books and edit their books and do all of this.
So awesome.
Yeah, it's really lovely. And now it's developed. I had to step down as CEO because I was spreading myself too thin. And also when I first started it, I was, I guess at that point, 21. And most of the people in the nonprofit were in their 30s and 40s. And being the CEO of a nonprofit who's a decade and a half younger than everyone else, it was just a very strange environment.
Right.
But it was a lot of good work being done. And so after 2 years, I had been okay, we've done this. They're about to have their third conference in June. And it's been really beautiful to see that there. What started off in 2019, completely crowdfunded, literally nothing, has now, I think there's 1,900, 2,000 people in the community. They're going to have 100 panels and presentations and workshops. And there's archives of roughly 200 videos on YouTube right now for anyone who wants to learn about the craft of writing, about the business of writing, about all of these different elements. There is a well of information.
I will definitely have to link WriteHive and all that stuff down below when this finishes up, because that's some amazing stuff, an amazing community that has been built from this. So congratulations on that. That's super exciting.
Thank you so much.
But also exciting to see you go on and you're cool, this is in a good spot. I'm ready to go do other things. Which is also really special and really exciting too.
I think that's really important for a lot of people. I have done a lot of community organizing. I've done a lot of mutual aid. I've done a lot of work just trying to be a activist, as whatever that means.
Right.
And something that a lot of people don't realize is that it takes a lot of emotional energy, and you can burn out really easily.
Yeah.
And you're going to need to find a way to sustain that for yourself. And if you get to a point where you're working on something, even as much as it is really important to you and you think that you're doing good, if it is detrimental to your own mental health, you're actually not helping anybody. Yes. And that's something I think a lot more people need to realize with community works.
Yeah, no, I 100% agree with that. I think so many people would, but I think, again, it's a great thing to continue to share so people know this and realize it and take care of themselves more, because that's the main thing, folks. Just take care of yourselves.
Drink some water if you haven't. Just whoever's watching this, drink some water right now.
Yeah, exactly. Talking about things that are coming up for you, though, you're in the semifinals for the New York City Queer Comedy Festival. That's coming up on the 21st. Tell me about that.
Yes, so that is this Thursday for live. It's super cool. That was the video that I was talking about earlier. I had that first round in November. And getting to the second round was not something I actually thought was going to be possible, because I started so recently, but it's a very, very special and both ego boosting and humbling to be able to do that, to be wow. Okay, cool. So I have that one. I have a storytelling show on the 23rd. And then I have another one at Pit Loft in Midtown, Upper Manhattan, the 30th.
Amazing. Well, send me the links for those and I'll drop those down below. I mean, we've gotten through things enough that we still have 10 minutes still to chat, which is really exciting.
Okay.
One thing that you had mentioned, because I have everyone who's interested in being on the show, fill out this little form and be what do you want to talk about? Da, 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 da. But one thing that you had mentioned was how we've discussed the plethora of mediums you've worked in creatively and artistically, and how they all have completely different creative processes. And you had mentioned how you love how different forms inform each other and give each other insight. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. I think people don't realize how much they try to keep their art separately. At least that's what I did for myself. Right. Like, my music had no bearing on my acting, had no bearing on my writing. Or at least I thought that was the case.
Right.
But when you really realize, like when you really sit back and look at it, you think differently. Because when you really explore artistic mediums, you have to think about the world through the lens of that craft. Like cinematography, people really view the world differently because you're thinking of everything in composition. But when you're thinking about poetry, you're thinking about the world in terms of rhythm of words and the feelings that they evoke. But when you're thinking about prose writing, you're thinking more about how do I convey this information in a way that is engaging?
Yeah.
And when you're acting, you're like, how do I embody this experience and view the world through this character? And when you really, when you take a step back and compare all of those things, okay, so writing is just acting, but instead of saying the words out loud and thinking the process, you're writing that process down in words. And you're trying to describe that experience using the emotional language of poetry. And then you're listening to the rhythm of the poetry through how you understand the world through music. And really taking each bit and piece and making them come together into something more than they could have been on their own. I think that's very much, even if I hadn't realized it beforehand, when I started doing stand-up, I was like, oh, this is all of it coming together. Because stand-up, I am obviously acting. I think one of the reasons why I started doing so well is just because I had been an actor for 10 years. And so, like,
right.
No, everyone's like, you don't seem nervous on stage. And I get off and I'm like, I was having a panic attack, but you wouldn't know.
You exactly. Know
what I mean? And it's like, it's a skill that we develop.
Yeah. Yeah. No, totally. And it makes me think of, like, I'm discovering in playing with playwriting and things like that, that like the dancer parts of my brain engage and I write way too many stage directions. And like, I very much imagine people in the space when I'm writing. So like my stage directions can be a little more detailed than one would expect. Or like I write out my lines when I'm trying to memorize them because it's something about seeing them on the page and like the act of writing them out. And so I think it's absolutely true. It's like engaging all those different parts of your brain, your creative processes that bring it together. And it makes me think of like devised theater work. When you have lots of people in a space with completely different backgrounds, like just naturally you're going to have all these different mediums come together, you know?
That makes a lot of sense. Yeah, no, I hearing you talk about like dancing and thinking about it in like physical space, my brain doesn't work like that at all, but that is fascinating. Like that's incredible.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And like just the beauty of like live performance, like you're gonna have people with eyes on like the visuals, the written, the performative aspects. That's why we have designers and directors. And I think it's special then to think about like, oh, when I approach my one craft or one piece of art, let's try and like what happens if I add this other thing in? Like I remember I was just gonna say, like in devised theater, when like professors and things will say like, oh, like you have this thing that you created, you're adding a song now, congrats, figure it out. And just having to adapt to that and figure out, okay, how can it inform the work, kind of thing.
That's super cool.
No, that's okay, sorry.
no, it's completely okay. My brain just like scattered for a second.
That's okay.
Physical space.
We were talking about live performance when you have all these people, like the directors, the writers, designers.
Yes. There's something so beautiful about theater that is so unique in every other aspect. Like in film, there is this creation aspect of like everyone coming together, but it's in isolation. Like the actors are doing something with the directors, but the cinematographers aren't really talking to the actors. They're talking to the director. And like the person who does the score only talks, like the director is the focal point in a film. But that is still kind of true in theater, mm-hmm. but everyone needs to be working as a cohesive unit because it's live.
Right.
That there's something, it's like you can see the act of creation happening in real time.
Yeah. And I think it's so funny. I wasn't even thinking about this, but I think that's also a really good argument for like pro shot theater. Simply because like, yes, you have the camera doing all the things, but everyone else still has to work like an well-oiled machine in order to capture it.
Yep.
So, because
it's a film, but it's...
No, because like, obviously, like throughout being in like grad school and things like that, you have this conversation of like, what is liveness? And that gets really like hairy and philosophical. But I think just by saying that, I'm like, oh, there's the perfect argument for talking about whether pro shot is live or not.
Yeah. And also like with pro shot, unless it's a live stream, you're not getting it in real time. You're only getting it mm-hmm. after the fact. And they could still do a second take. They could do the whole thing again yeah. and then cut. They cut all the things together. And like, just like stand-up. Like that's why a stand-up special is not what you see when you go to a club and like you mm-hmm. just watch someone do 15 minutes, half an hour.
Yeah.
Because you're watching people go, okay, hold, like I was at a filming for a comedy special recently and the guy stopped midway through his set, went, okay, we're not doing that take. I'm going to start the joke over again, everyone. And I was like, what?
You're like, you can do that?
Apparently when you're being filmed, they're getting paid for it. I don't know.
I guess. That makes me think of, I was watching a Netflix special, as you do. And I don't remember what it was, but it was definitely one of those like small series where everyone had like a 30-minute set. Mm-hmm. And so it was, each episode was different. And there was one episode, it was this male comedian. And I remember he's just like, yo, I got a list of jokes. We're going to try them. There's not going to be any segue. And that's what he did the whole set. And like throughout, he would be like, yeah. And write a little note or like, oh, you guys didn't like that. Okay, like scratches it out or like makes it just, and like something about that was so funny to me. Like, I don't,
that's
like,
what you get live all the time.
Exactly. And I think that there's something so cool and so fun about that. And part of why I love doing this show live, but also I want to make sure it's accessible for people who can't watch live.
Mm-hmm. Important.
Exactly. Just like making that little distinction there. But yeah. We've kind of come to the end here, which is crazy because, again, you and I are very long-winded people. We can talk for so long. And I'm sure we will get to in person soon,
yes,
which will be a grand old time. I think we already talked about it a little bit, but where can people find you on the internets?
You can find Rowan on Twitter, TikTok, and Instagram at Rowan Zioli. And their editing website is rowanzioli.com.
Definitely you can reach out to me booking there or DM me. My DMs are pretty much open.
Cool.
That's probably not great.
You're like, maybe not, but that's okay. I've had people say on here, they're like, find me on Facebook. And I'm like, ooh, okay. I mean, you do you, but that's, yeah, no, no judgment. You can find me on Instagram and Twitter at Laura_Marjoram and on my website, www.lauramarjoram.com. You can find this lovely show on Instagram at Overtures Show. There's two S's. It is correct. Of course, if you're watching live, congrats, you found the YouTube channel. Hooray. That's all I got. Subscribe, like, comment. We love that. Do you have any final thoughts for viewers live and in the future?
This was absolutely delightful. Just be nice to people because shit's hard. It's rough out there and this too shall pass, you know?
Yep. And with the wise words of Tyler Zioli. Although they're probably said by someone else first, but that's okay. We're going to attribute them to
maybe
you.
Maybe like King Solomon. I don't know. I think that, who's to say?
But with that, hopefully everyone else has a great night, day. I don't know when you're watching or listening, but yeah.
Time's fake.
Exactly.